It's a real thing, and people don't understand it. And I have said to many, if you take an instrument out of my hands, my rhythm drops to zero. I need an instrument, or the rhythm is gone.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
So how did you start? How did you meet Trent, and how did that come about?
Well, the story goes, legend. Long story short, I was playing with another band circa 2007, and we were playing just before Nine Inch Nails at Reading and Leeds. Now, Trent saw me play, and I'm pretty sure it was because my friend Jeremy had been working for Nine Inch Nails. He was teching for Josh Fries, who was the current drummer at the time, and then Jerome Dillon before him. And, you know, now having known Trent for a long time, I'm shocked that he went on stage to go watch me play. And because the band was certainly not his style, but he went, remembered me. And then it was about a year later that Josh announced he would be leaving the band. And I got an email from Trent asking if I would be interested in auditioning, saying that he saw me perform, this and that. And of course, it was a no-brainer. I went out to audition during a sound check on the Lights in the Sky tour, which they were doing in 2008. So they were having drummers fly in to play a few songs at sound checks, so that when that tour ended at the end of 2008, the band could still pick up rehearsals first thing 2009 and get moving. So that's when I joined the band.
Wow. Oh, okay. So that's kind of a smart move, really, because they're auditioning you not in a small room somewhere, but in situ.
Yeah. And it was a sound check at a freezing cold arena somewhere on the East Coast. And it was a good time, but it's also, I agree with you. It's smart because obviously they're going to be picking from a pool of either recommendations or people they've seen. It's not like an open call audition, but yeah, you want to know that whoever it is can get up on stage and just immediately do the thing and play in that kind of ensemble. And so, yeah, it was, that was about 14 years ago now, whatever it is.
It's a good story. I was wondering, but it begs the question for me anyway. Do you, because there's a way of playing it in that size of space, even within ears, I think. I'm not sure, but because I don't have that much experience with, you know. But what's it like making the switch? Do you still have the opportunity to play intimate, small venues as well?
You mean generally or with Nine Inch Nails?
No, generally. I mean, in just with your other interests as well.
Yeah, I think it really depends more so not on the venue, but the type of music. Because if it's an energetic type of music, you're going to bring the energy, whether it's a 200 capacity venue or the O2. And that comes with the music. Now, that being said, I haven't really had much opportunity to play drums live on tour for things that weren't inherently energetic, which is why when I'm in the studio and let's say I get called in to do a session and it's not something that's rock per se or up tempo, I really love playing that stuff. I mean, some of the favorite sessions I've done have been with Beck, actually. So it's a little more groove oriented and a little more in the pocket, because, you know, a lot of people have seen me play and they will ask me to come in and play on the recording based on what they've seen of me. But if I'm at my blockout or whatever playing drums, I'm not playing as if I'm on stage with Nine Inch Nails. It's far groovier, a little more intricate and more drummy, so to speak, right? You know? And so I really think it comes from the music more so than the place.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'm going to ask you a question here now that relates to Trent. And, you know, a few years ago, Well, we have another friend of ours who came on this show a little while back, who plays with Pearl Jam and had played with the Chili Peppers, Josh Klinghoffer. And a few years ago, I got to enter the Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I suggested that Trent come and introduce us, and he graciously did. And that was nice, you know, and it was one of my favorite evenings for many reasons. But Josh was telling us that you usurped him as the youngest member ever of, you know, he was gnashing teeth and stuff when he told us, you know, he wasn't at all. He was very funny about it. But he said, you know, he had been the youngest inductee, and then all of a sudden this other fella came along, and that was you, right?
This is true. I am apologetic towards him. We've actually never met, but yes, it's a funny thing.
You can vicariously meet. We'll introduce you right here. Josh, come back.
I think that's a good podcast idea, where there's a mediator and then just two musicians who don't know each other are thrown into a conversation. No, I've heard nothing but great things about him and his playing. We have not met, but yeah, that was one of those things. And you know, if that matters to him at all, I would imagine that the most painful part is that it was a matter of like 6 to 8 months. Yeah. it wasn't a wide gap, because he was, I believe, I'd imagine 32 when he was inducted, and I was 32. And it did get delayed a little bit, because obviously 2020 was the year of Armageddon, and we unfortunately did not get to do the delightful evening that you guys had, and it was kind of being relegated to the couch watching this thing on HBO months later. But I'm proud of it. I mean,
yes,
I got the trophy up there, but I'm well aware that Nine Inch Nails would be there without me ever having hit a note.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's nice that you're in it. I have two of those statues, because the first one they sent me broke, and they thought I was going to send it back, and I never sent it back, so they just sent me another one. So now I have two. I have a spare one.
That's excellent.
Yeah. And
there's one slightly flawed.
Yes.
If you get a third, you can compete with Clapton three times.
Yeah, there you go.
I bet he hasn't got a flawed one, lol. I bet he's an old pristine.
Yeah. Well, I can repair it. I can repair my one. It just broke. That's all.
Yeah, of course you can. Bit of super glue, it'll be fine.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Sand it down, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Alessandro, who lives in Portugal, received his broken, and I think he's now used it as a toilet paper holder or a bog roll holder, however you want to refer to it.
How they say it. I don't know. I haven't lived there for those many years. I had to think about that one for a second.
Yeah.
So when we were about to do it, you know, I was talking backwards and forwards with Robert about it, and he's like, I don't know if I'm going to do it. You know, what isn't it like, you know, another? And I said, you know, I've lived out here a quarter of a century. No, I said, people will dig that we did it, because for them, it's like, you know, it's recompense for getting chased by the jocks and the metalheads down the street of their little town for being, you know, a goth or something, you know.
Yeah.
I said, they will like it. They will feel really good about it. And he was like, I'm not sure. And then the first thing that Trent said when he got out on stage was, you know, growing up in a little small town in, you know, Pennsylvania, looking at wheat fields.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing that kept me sane was, like, I could hear this music coming through college radio. And I was looking at Robert going, see, look, what I tell you, you know, I think in you anyway.
And what's funny is that I know, Trent's opinion, for example, changed, yeah, I think as a result of inducting you guys, because it's easy to see something like that as just a get together for everybody to pat each other on the back and
sure,
maybe not feel like it's a real personal achievement of sorts, you know, but once you're there and you do it and you see that it's appreciated, it's a great thing to be a part of. And I think that really did alter his perspective, whereas it was probably something he did not care about in the slightest years right leading up to that. And then he actually took it more seriously when he was inducted. So, yeah.
Well, I always go back to that old thing that Joe Strummer said about Top of the Pops, you know, the TV show that we had in England that everybody was on. But, you know, when punk came along, everybody's like, oh, we're never going to top. And he said, well, if I don't go on, if we don't go on, somebody else will, so we might as well do it. So it's us, you know, and it's, it's right. You know, if you don't enter into the arena, you can't complain, you know?
Queen's one of my favorites. I always recall Brian May referring to Top of the Pops as the great vehicle for selling records.
Yeah.
They didn't want to do it, but they felt they had to.
Yeah. It's a great vehicle for confusing people as well. I remember speaking with, who was it now? I think it was Talvin Singh, you know, tabla player. And he saw the Creatures play on Top of the Pops. And he said, I saw you playing this, and it was the marimba. But I'd rented one, and it was like made out of resin. The blocks are made of resin, so you could shine light through them.
Oh, wow.
And the smoke was there as well. And it just looked like this luminous object that I was playing. He just thought it was the coolest thing and thought, that's what I want. I'm going to move into electronics. So do you consider yourself a drummer first off?
Well, it's undeniably my first instrument, and it's what I'm most comfortable doing. But honestly, as time has passed on, I've really come to see myself more as a musician. And while that may feel or come across as a bit pretentious, what I mean by that is for the first 4 or 5 years of my musical life, it was entirely drumming. And I had tunnel vision for it, didn't care about anything else. But having two older brothers who were also into music, there was a bass and there was a guitar in the house. And the same obsessive bug that hit me with the drums hit me with the guitar and hit me with the bass. And then eventually hit me with the piano. And now, even though 34 years old isn't necessarily the oldest of ages, I'm at a point where, yes, I've played drums for however long it's been, but I've also played guitar for 20 years now, or bass for 20 years, and those things are just as much a part of me. And I pendulum back and forth between obviously touring as a drummer, in which case I'm spending the majority of my time playing drums, but when I'm home, I'm spending more time with guitars and pianos, writing and recording, and really the only time I'm playing drums is to record. Things just take different priority.
Can you remember the first time you stepped out from behind the kit with the guitar on a big stage next to guitarists who only stepped out with guitars? I mean, did you model yourself on somebody, or did it just come, this is the way I play guitar, you know, this is the way I sing, this is the way I...
Well, you know, the difficult thing about singing as opposed to any other instrument is that you are, to a degree, given the instrument that you have as a vocalist. And yes, you can improve that, you can better yourself, but as much as I would love to kick on the Robert Plant or the Freddie Mercury pedal, it's not going to happen with my voice, you know, whereas you can learn somebody's style to a degree or tonally mimic things if you wanted to. So as a singer, it's really a result of the kinds of melodies that I have come to write. And that would be an amalgamation of the music I like, you know, but obviously I have to put the voice up to sing the melodies that I've written. And I think that has just resulted in the way that I sing. As a guitar player, it's very much the way it is for any other instrument. You know, as a drummer, you're parts of whoever it is you grew up listening to. And for guitar, I mean, anything I play directly does go back to Led Zeppelin. I mean, I'm gonna be redundant in a broken record, but each of those guys are my favorite in their respective instruments. So it always goes there.
It's interesting that you said you thought of yourself as a musician, and I for many years they say, what do you do? And they say, I'd say I play drums. They say, oh, musician, and I go, no, I play drums. I'm a drummer, you know. I might be a percussionist, but I am also, I might even dabble on guitar. But and the reason I said that is because I didn't feel like I'm not the guy who I never saw. I could see guitarists and bass players and people and keyboard players especially working on chord shapes and structures and but I didn't do that. I didn't think I did that. I didn't think I had much part in that process. Until much, much later, and then I went, do you know what? I am a musician.
Absolutely.
And it hit me with such a resonance that I thought, I've denied myself that title for such a long time.
It's an interesting thing because obviously, I mean, let's specify drummer as opposed to percussionist, right?
Yeah.
It's such an integral part of music, and it can change the way music feels. But as drummers, we're not focusing on anything melodic, nothing harmonic. It all has to do with the way something feels and the level of energy we're putting forth. Now, when it comes to more melodic instruments, whether it be guitar, let's say guitar for example. Yes, you're working on progressions, you're working on leads and whatnot, and you can play loudly, but nothing will ever bring forth what a drum set or a drummer can bring to the table. And the reason why I specify drummers, because obviously there are orchestral percussionists who are playing marimbas and glockenspiels and, you know, mallet pianos, if you will.
Yeah.
And obviously that's more, I was about to say more musical, but I mean more melodic. And that's just one of those things that drummers are so integral, but they're far removed from what people usually consider to be the basis of music, yeah. Pitch, melody.
Personally, I blame guitarists and bass players and singers for introducing that thing because they try and minimize the thing. And you know what? A band, I don't care. Any band is only as good as its drummer. Really is. You know, if you haven't got a good drummer, your band's crap. I don't care how good you are, your band's crap.
Absolutely.
The Banshees went through quite a lot of guitarists. So when you've got, like, you're starting with another guitarist, they can listen to all the recordings. But somebody's got to go, it's not quite the right tone. And you don't change that chord right now. Wait till I come to that pit, right? Okay, and you'll hear me do this fill.
Yeah.
And I realized that. And when the guitarist who was our last guitarist said, you were the one who always sang me the guitar parts. I had much better idea from your singing those parts and playing with you than any chart that might have been or video of somebody else playing it. And that's when I started to just kind of, okay, I get it.
Yeah, and obviously there are singing bass players out there, but there's just something inherent about a guitar and a piano as being instruments that are so easily sung over.
Right.
And that, I think, leads to the whole, I'm a musician because I play this and I can sing on top of it. And obviously there's singing drummers as well, but I don't think most people are there playing a beat and just singing to themselves. I could be wrong, but that's not something I do.
That's what I do. So I got Susie to sing over my drums.
Yes.
And that became the Creatures. That was it. We just drums and voice.
Yeah, and that's all you need. And that's all that people listen to at the end of the day. Somebody told me, like, you know, hey, if you've got a hit record, the only thing they're listening to is the voice and the rhythm. And that's us, you know. But here's the thing. I took it a step further because I thought I had the same internal conversation in my head as you, Raji, about, you know, like, I'm a drummer. Am I a musician? My sister's a musician. She's a piano teacher, you know. So, I'm like, okay. Am I a musician? And then I decided after I started writing a few years ago and realizing I could do that, is like, I am a creative person. I am an artist. That's what I am, you know. I just do it in different ways with different things, you know. And you remind me, Elon, very much of Pearl Thompson. He's the sort of person that you could give him any instrument, especially one he'd never played or even seen in his life. And by the end of the evening, he's playing it and he's got a tune out of it or something. You know, it's like he's very, very, you want to brick his hands, you know, you want to go, no, you can't do that.
Yes, this is what Stuart Copeland says about Sting in a wonderful documentary, and saying, so it's Sting's birthday, we're backstage at some mega venue, and he goes, I'm going to give him something he can't possibly. So I arrive with a tuba.
Yeah.
And he says, I walk down the corridor, and before I reach back to my room, I can hear the tuba playing this beautiful tune. He goes, Dingo!
It's like Pearl. We gave him a saxophone. He came someplace where you give him a saxophone. We thought he'd never play anything. And all of a sudden, there's like...
Yeah. So what's the instrument? What's the instrument you haven't played yet? Ilan?
Oh, I mean, there's so many, but I will say this. The violin really put me in my place.
Ooh,
because I developed this love of classical music when I was about 15 or 16 years old through the piano. And at that point, I felt kind of unstoppable. I was like, I got good at playing drums. I got good at playing guitar, bass, piano. What's next? So I got a violin, and the amount of time it took me to get a somewhat intonated G major scale up and down was so strenuous. I said, the amount of time it would take me to get good at this is time I don't have to spare. So I politely put it in its case, and I'm sure I've made noises with it at some point. But
sent it on its way.
Yeah. What's funny though is years after that, Trent asked me just before doing a tour in 2013. He's like, "Do you play the cello?" And my response was, "Not yet, but what are you looking for?" You know, because I do like a challenge.
Mm.
And he wanted some cello on a couple of songs. Now, granted, this is not some Yo-Yo Ma virtuosity here. Fortunately, the three songs were all in the same key, same three notes.
So you got good at them.
Yeah, but he got me lessons every Wednesday or Thursday after rehearsal. Somebody would come over and teach me a semblance of vibrato and all that fun stuff. But that I feel like I could get better at. I mean, it's just a larger instrument. It's in front of you as opposed to this weird angle. I have wanted to try the viola, considering that's bigger than the violin and it's an octave up from the cello. So I've wanted to. But going to woodwinds, I realized in the pandemic, it was a great opportunity for me to finally get into film scoring. I mean, it's a great way of combining the worlds of orchestral music, electronic music, anything goes as long as it works to the picture. And I was reading these orchestration manuals and I realized I have never held, let alone been in a room with a woodwind instrument or a brass instrument. So this is when we thought COVID was going to be 2 weeks or 2 months at the most. I got myself a beginner's clarinet and was able to play a scale up and down, and then same thing. I was immediately hit with guilt where I was like, you know, this is a rare gift of time that I've not had, and I should probably do something more productive than learn the clarinet. But I scratch the itch easily. If I do something and I know I can do it, that's satisfying enough for me. But you know, I never cared to be a virtuoso of the clarinet. But
the clarinet's a good instrument to walk around with. I mean, it looks cool. out of all the instruments, it looks cool. You know, you could casually have it across your shoulder, like, oh yeah, I play the clarinet.
I'm sure that all the cello cases I see strapped to people's backs here in Berlin don't contain cellos at all. They're all clarinets.
How did you end up in Berlin, if I may ask?
My friend Toby Dammit, better known as Toby Dammit, he was living here and I was in France and I needed to get out of France. And I called him and I heard his shoes on the cobblestones wherever he was walking. I said, Larry, because that's his real name, where are you? He said, I'm just outside my apartment in Berlin. And he said, you can come here. So he was on tour. Larry used to play with Iggy Pop. They played with Swans. He's always been with good musical circles. Right. Anyway, so I go and stay at his place. I land in an apartment in the center of Berlin, right in, what do you call it, Kreuzberg. And there's a studio in the roof of this building, like a home studio. And like you get people like Peaches would walk in to do some vocals. And I think, she looks like she's cool. Mm. And then somebody says, that's Peaches. She lives around the corner. And I'm like, wow. And it was just like, I thought, I could make a go of it here. I like this place.
It's an amazing place. It's incredible.
It really is. It's changing all the time. It's changed. I've been here just over 10 years now. But it really radically changing all the time. But it's still a massive city, you know, spread out like LA spreads out. Yeah. But it's also very grimy as well. Grotty, grimy, and grisly. That's what I called it with my daughter the other day. Look at this tube, this underground carriage. It's real grotty, grimy, and grisly. And that's Berlin, really. It doesn't really care what's hanging out.
But immaculately efficient. You know, that tube is on time.
Yeah. They'd say it's going to be a minute late, and that minute then gets carried on if you look at your like app and the timetable. You know, it's, yeah, super efficient until it's not.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place, though.
So what happened to make you move up from San Diego to L.A.? I'm in L.A. I've been here for many years.
It has to be the efficiency of the metro, right?
Yes, right.
The urban transit system.
I honestly avoided L.A. for as long as I possibly could. I never really enjoyed it, to be honest with you. And a big part of that is that home, where I was comfortable, was only 2 hours down the freeway. So I never really felt that pull. But what I did realize the older I got is that it's far more efficient given what I do, given what we do, you know, and you just find yourself in situations where, okay, you're in San Diego, you drive up to LA for an hour meeting. That hour meeting takes your entire day between driving, avoiding traffic, finding a way to come down. It's so inefficient. And in particular, it just felt great for the occasional sessions and recordings. It's a lot more, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? Are you available next week? Just things that you could kind of go do, but then I could come back and still continue things that I was working on. It was just more efficient. And especially within being between touring cycles, you're there, you're able, or you're here, and you're able to do whatever it is that you need to do. And then even rehearsing, you know, any band I've ever played with the exception of Angels and Airwaves, which is based out of San Diego, the chunks of rehearsal time are all in LA. So I just had to finally submit and say, this is just going to be easier for me.
I don't know. For me, you know, I never thought I would be living here. That wasn't on my plan of things like, yeah, you're going to live here, bring up your son here. No, that wasn't going to happen. And then I got here and I found a lot of love and a lot of acceptance. And I'd been going through a very bad time in my life beforehand. I moved out here in like 94, and it was like a breath of fresh air, and everything changed for me. So I feel like this place is home now. And I never thought it would be, like, you know, all those years touring with The Cure, I sort of liked California, but I wasn't like thinking, oh yeah, I'll move here.
And I'm very much a creature of habit as well, which is why it was difficult for me to finally make the move. But once I did and I felt comfortable, it's a good place. But with anything, it's got its pros and its cons. And the destructive qualities for some would definitely be a con as far as LA is concerned. What do we have here?
And these are my business cards. So convinced was I that I was going to move to LA. I had a business card. I got a little suite, 1890 on Wiltshire Boulevard. And never came off. Something was always pulling me the opposite direction. But I really wanted, LA was always a place where I could get things were happening, or there was an atmosphere of let's get the work done. So that rehearsal situation I talked about with getting the Creatures together, it became a place, let's go and do the tour prep, because we'd always start in America.
There you go.
I was driving around LA with Japanese taiko drummer Leonard Eto. And Leonard and I, we did an album together with, and then it became a Creatures album. But we were driving to rehearsal over, is it Sire? The over in the valley, anyway.
SIR?
SIR, something like that. I don't think it is. It's another smaller one. And
Let's go with the British pronunciation, Sire. I like it a lot. It's nice.
With Sire.
Okay, Sire. And so every stoplight and the indicator's going, and we're both like tapping away on the car, on the plastic of the, you know, I'm going to say it was an Escalade, but it probably wasn't. Or I might have been borrowing an Escalade. But it was like, and the rhythms that were coming up, I thought, we have to do a track. How many people have done tracks with, you know?
Oh, that's it, isn't it? Yeah.
Tell me if this drives you guys crazy. to use the British term, we'll call them indicators.
Indicators.
But when you're at a stoplight and your indicator and the person in front of you's indicator is pulsating, and then you see them drifting apart.
Driving
out of time, yeah.
Oh, it drives me nuts. Yeah. It drives me nuts.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Drummer's Hour.
Yeah. Some people will listen to that and think, yeah, cool. And some people will think they need therapy.
We do. You know,
because it's
my wife tells me all the time.
I've been learning, as Budgie knows, I've been learning taiko recently.
Oh, wow.
That's been a lot of fun. Yeah, there's a big place out here in LA, big center in Torrance, and I've been going
there. Awesome.
And learning it. It's a lot, but it's hard because you're not just playing drums. I mean, the drum part of it is not super, super difficult, but the choreography and drumming at the same time is bloody impossible.
Yeah, I can't dance.
No. Well, I found out I can't either, and they tell me every time I'm there that you can't dance.
What is this about drummers that we can't dance?
It's a real thing, and people don't understand it, and I have said to many, if you take an instrument out of my hands, my rhythm drops to zero. I need an instrument or the rhythm is gone. But, you know, the taiko thing, what inspired you to do that?
I just got to, what we'd like to say euphemistically, the third act of our lives. And I thought, you know, mm-hmm. I want to keep cognitively active, so I better do something different every year. And mm-hmm. this year I decided I'm going to learn taiko because I always liked it. I always, you know, like watching people play and stuff. And so my friend of mine is in a taiko group, and they told me, oh, go here. This is like the best place. And it's good, but it's kind of different than what we do, you know, because like one hand, you know, the instructor will always pull me up on my left hand because he says, you know, you don't hold it up in the air like you're supposed to on these things. I said, yeah, because I play kit, you know, and that's where my hand's going to be naturally, you know. It's just,
yeah.
I can't stop it. I've had to unlearn that bit, you know.
I think I applied taiko from watching them, you know, kind of,
yeah.
Like, raise his hands above both heads and like really come down and like stop at the last minute. That was my revelation moment when I got in front of Leonard's huge odaiko and I, the big, you know, handmade beaters, these thick. I'd made my own out of broom steels, you know, like kind of cut them down because I had a big old bass drum up on an X frame at the side of the stage and that was going to be my kind of taiko.
Right.
But I had the head quite loose, you know, so there was no real resonance in it. I can't believe how hard, how tight the head was. This 50-year-old buffalo hide, you know, it's like stapled to this beautiful piece of tree, and the sticks just kind of like,
yes,
and the drum throws you off. And that's what Leonard was telling me, was you don't play into the drum, you're kind of catching the sticks as they come off the drum. Incredible. It's like totally different.
I've had the opportunity to play a taiko, and they're amazing instruments. I was playing drums on a film score, but they had all the rented percussion around, so I kind of just had some fun hitting stuff, and it was really interesting. And having had that minimal experience, I was really surprised and impressed to see when Danny Elfman played his couple of shows at the Hollywood Bowl a few months back, he had two taiko drummers on stage. And I'm like, man, what a thing that would be to play that instrument on stage live. It's such a different setting to say, you know, a giant soundstage of a studio to record something.
I do have a sort of vision that when me and Budgie get out there and start playing live shows, that Mr. Roland gives us a couple of his electronic taiko stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And we can, you know, march across the stage with those things.
We're gonna, you have to dance with them though, lol. That's all part of that thing.
I don't mind. We can figure out a dance that you and I could do. It'd be sort of like David Byrne, you know, like the non-dancing, you know, it'll be okay.
That's what I do, non-dancing dancing. That's my style of dance.
So it's been wonderful to talk to you. It really has.
We are the three that would be in the corner in the party, and they go, "What are those guys doing over there?" I said, they're the drummers.
They're having a better time than we are.
That's the drummers. They're just sitting there and talking paradiddles and nonsense.
Yeah. You know,
this has been great. Thanks, Elon. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Hey, pleasure's mine. Thank you for having me.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Butchie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas K.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.